acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 83, Secrets of Red. Friday, July 24th, 2015. I'm your host, Sarah, podcasting from the rehearsal space of Bovine Social Club. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. This week's podcast features the following segments: ever-expanding skill set, the back porch, the front porch, and off the shelf. Last week, I titled my episode Ecstasy, and usually at some point during the podcast, I make a reference to the title of the episode. Well, I totally forgot to talk about making sweet corn or corn on the cob on our grill. And so the title of the episode and the episode cover seemed a little out of place. So I didn't alter the audio file, but I did replace the cover photo and the title with something that made a little bit more sense, since I talked a great deal about the tasting menu that Samuel and I prepared at a local restaurant. So this week in Secrets of Red, I want to make a point of talking about a variety of sweet corn called Ecstasy. I picked some up when I purchased the peaches for our tasting menu dessert, and the grower who was vending at our local farmer's market was also selling sweet corn, and he said, well, the name of the sweet corn is Ecstasy. That gives you some idea. And I said, I'll be the judge of that. And I bought 6 ears and we made them that very night. I think it's important when buying sweet corn not to waste time finding it and buying it unless you're going to be able to eat it that very day. Even just hours after picking is really the best. There's kind of a, you know, like farmer's folklore that says you should, you know, set the water boiling on the stove and then run into the field and pick your corn and bring it back. Which is one of the reasons I wanted to talk about sweet corn, because Samuel and I have kind of a tried and true method of making corn on the cob on our grill, and I wouldn't prepare it any other way. So I thought I would share it. And if you live in a rural area or you are lucky enough to live near a farmer's market in the U.S., maybe you're already familiar with all the ways to prepare sweet corn. But for the uninitiated, I encourage you to try this method. I suppose it's somewhat unusual because it doesn't involve boiling the ears of corn. When I was growing up, my family and extended family spent Memorial Day, 4th of July, Labor Day, having picnics outdoors on my grandparents' farm. It's, you know, very much a part of my childhood memories. And my maternal grandmother was something of a like culinary gadgets addict. She was always buying sort of the latest little kind of gadget for the kitchen or for eating. Or I don't know, maybe she had friends who had parties and sold these kinds of products, but it just seemed like every time there was a picnic, she had some new contraption. And many times it revolved around corn on the cob. So she had these little plastic pieces of corn with prongs on them that we would use and insert one on each end of the corn on the cob so you could sort of rotate it and eat the corn on the cob without touching your salty, buttery ear of corn. So that was a trend that we did for a while. And then she had this really weird plastic contraption that fit over a regular size stick of butter, and it had a little indentation in it so that you could take your ear of corn and you could sort of roll it along the top of this stick of butter and get the entire ear coated. Just really weird stuff like that. And every time I eat corn on the cob, some of those memories sort of flash in my mind. But this method, no boiling, no contraptions, it's really cool. So what you do is you get your farmer's market fresh sweet corn, and I do recommend Ecstasy if you can find it, because it really is nice and sweet with small kernels. And what I do is I just peel off just before, maybe about a half hour before I'm ready to start up the grill. I remove the very outermost layer of husk, kind of the brightest green, toughest part of the husk. Just peel it back a little bit, leaving all of the silk and the rest of the husk on the ear of corn. And then there's usually sort of a stub at the base of an ear of corn, and you can leave that on or break that off depending on how much room you have on your grill and how many ears you're trying to roast at one time. So after I do that, I submerge all of the ears of corn into a basin or a bucket of very cold water, or I could fill up my sink with some cold water and just stick the ears of corn in there and let them go for, anywhere from 15 to 30 minutes. They're just soaking in this cold water. Start up the grill. We have our big green egg charcoal grill. The heat gets very, very, very intense. And I like to put the ears of corn on the grill when the heat is about 400 to 450 degrees. It could be even higher. Usually, once you put cold food into it and you have the grill open, the temperature sinks a little bit and then it starts to climb. But I like the grill to be very, very, very hot. So I fill it with ears of corn. My big green egg is a medium size, so the size of the grill is rather small, and I can fit 6 to 8 ears of corn on that grill surface. They're pretty crowded, but that's okay for this. And then I let them roast. Periodically, I open the grill and I rotate the corn and sort of, move things from the outside to the inner part of the grill and vice versa, and just keep everything moving around until the husks look incredibly brittle and charred. This takes anywhere from, 5 to 15 minutes. If the grill is really hot, it can go pretty fast. And then I remove the ears of corn from the grill and let them sit until they're just, you can barely touch them, but you just can't wait for the sweet corn. So you have to start peeling the husk back. The silk, which is so difficult to remove when you're peeling your sweet corn and it's fresh, just comes out so easily with this preparation. And then the husk just folds back. You don't have to break the pieces off. I just peel them back and use that to hold my ear of corn. And I like to butter my sweet corn with a square of bread with a pat of cold butter on it. So I take a high quality bread or whatever we have around, and I cut each slice into quarters, and then I put a nice little pat of cold butter right on the piece of bread. And then you can use the bread to manipulate around your ear of corn and butter every, crevice and cranny with an equal amount of butter. and put on your salt. And sometimes I like to use grated Parmesan cheese or maybe some cayenne pepper for a little bit of heat. But really, just butter and salt is so amazing. And then you have this gorgeous piece of bread with delicious melted butter on it. So that's sort of like an appetizer for your corn. And then we eat our corn on the cob leaning over the porch railing, you know, with butter sort of dripping down on the ground and charred pieces of corn husks kind of flying off. It is ecstasy. It is wonderful. The corn gets, often it gets some little charred kernels here and there, and it just has this delicious, delicious taste. And the other thing about using that method is you can just devote your full attention to corn on the cob. And once your corn is done, you can put other things on your grill because usually that high heat has subsided and now the grill is, you know, 300, 350 degrees and great for cooking hamburgers or chicken or something like that. I like to make as much corn as I buy just in one shot and roast all of it. Usually we can eat two pieces each, and then with the remainder of the corn, I just peel back the husk. And this could be much later when I'm cleaning up from dinner and, you know, the corn is now cold and it's not really optimum for eating, but I just take a very sharp knife and slice all of the kernels off. And over the course of the summer, I gradually fill freezer bags with that nice kind of smoky corn kernels. And I use those for soups and stews and chili and things like that throughout the winter. So it's a great way to, you know, put some things by for another season without devoting your entire afternoon to, you know, oh, I'm going to cut and freeze corn. I just do it bit by bit throughout the summer, and then I have this wonderful supply of corn. If you haven't tried this method, I encourage you to try it. If you have great tips for enjoying sweet corn, or if there's something that you like to put on your sweet corn in the summer, I would love to hear about it because I just buy it every chance I get, and it's just such a wonderful summertime treat. All right, so 13 minutes on sweet corn. I hope you enjoyed that. For ever-expanding skill set, I wanted to talk a little bit about a segment on a podcast called The Splendid Table that I heard recently. I was listening to some back episodes, and there was something very interesting pertaining to the counter space and the kitchen counter. All year this year, I am exploring ideas for a powerful pantry, a more highly functional kitchen, thoughtful ways of doing everyday preparation, as well as things for special events. And each month I select sort of an area of the kitchen on which to focus. So for July, we've been talking about countertops. And I've had a lot of folks commenting recently that, you know, some of the segments are more thoughtful and thought-provoking than they initially expected. I guess when you hear, like, we're going to talk about refrigerators, maybe your eyes sort of glaze over. But listeners have been making really excellent suggestions and posts in the threads on Ravelry, and there's been some great conversation going on. During the month of July, quite a few folks have posted photographs of their counter space and counter organization and solutions. So there's a lot going on, and I encourage you to, you know, check out the threads and maybe make a post, share a photograph if you want to. So I was listening to The Splendid Table, which along with Good Food from KCRW is my favorite of the culinary podcasts. Great listening, and I hadn't been keeping up to date on all of the episodes, so I was listening to a back episode, which I have linked, by the way, in the show notes. And the host, Lynn Rosetto Casper, had an interview with Brian Wansink, and he studies food and eating and sort of cultural things having to do with eating at Cornell, I believe. And he is the author of Slim by Design. So he was explaining how to think about not necessarily dieting, because this is more like forming good habits and making lifestyle choices and changes rather than dieting for a finite amount of time with specific goals in mind. And he talks about the difference between reducing calorie and fat intake by sheer willpower and reducing it just by adjusting the design of your space and your life so that you're making healthy choices without really having to think about it. So your default is healthy, in other words. And he cited this interesting study they did where they had these subjects of the study come in and they were meeting someone for, you know, a conversation or a meeting. And when they came into a kitchen setting with a center island and some stools. And half of the subjects of the study came into a kitchen that was very tidy and organized. And the other half entered a kitchen that was like really chaotic, specifically with lots of stuff all over the countertops. And in all cases, there were bowls of three different kinds of snacks sort of on the counter right in front of where they were sitting. And they were told, oh, you know, the person you're meeting for an appointment is just going to be a few minutes. So, you know, just hang out here and they'll be out shortly. And they found that the folks who were waiting in a chaotic and messy kitchen consumed 44% more of the snacks than the folks who came in to a clean and serene environment, suggesting that tidiness and organization really help us focus on our food and what we're eating. And the disruption and chaos of a crazy environment actually makes us consume more food, more calories. And that's not even, it doesn't even feel like a choice. It doesn't even feel like you're thinking about it. That's just something about the environment that influences our behavior. So I thought this was really interesting. This was one of only five items that he mentioned during the interview. And I think it's really interesting to enough to give a listen to the rest of the segment and maybe even check out this Slim by Design. It's a book. I have not read it. I had never heard of it until I heard this interview on The Splendid Table. But I thought it was just a really fascinating link to a conversation we've been having this month about countertops. I always feel like I'm more creative and I'm more eager to make something and be industrious in my kitchen when I enter it and it's neat and tidy and things are where they belong. And it's kind of a joy to start making something than if I enter the kitchen and like before I do anything, the first thing I have to do is sort of clean it all up and put everything away. So that's the way I've been thinking about it, and I never even thought like maybe I'd be more likely to snack or eat unhealthy foods while I'm in there if the environment is not tidy. The back porch. In the past week, I have completed the Hapa shawl. It's a design by Mel of the Emski Knits podcast, and she's a designer with a lot of patterns. This is a two-color shawl, and Hapa means blended or intermixed. So the shifts between the two colors in the shawl is very interesting, and she has some really cool techniques. The purchased pattern includes incredibly helpful and clear video links, and Mel, of course, is just so charming when she explains the different techniques for the shawl. I knit this shawl in Foster Farm yarn that I purchased on the yarn tour of Washington County. It's 80% Romney, 20% Wensleydale yarn. It is milled locally right in Washington County. And Carol, who is the owner and shepherdess of the Foster Farm, is just so lovely and gracious and hand-dyed the yarn herself. I chose a beautiful gray color and a bright grassy green color. They play really well against one another with this pattern in the shawl. And I used US size 6 needles. This is worsted weight yarn. It's a really woolly yarn. Not that comfortable to work with in the heat of July, but once I had soaked and, you know, blocked the shawl, it's heavy enough that I just stretched it out. It really grew. It's a very long and narrow sort of shawl. I used 440 yards of yarn. I think these yarns came in 225 yard skeins. And I'm calling this shawl Crack in the Sidewalk because of the gray and the green. It will be a gift, and I'll be eager to just try it on to see how it feels when the weather is very cool. Right now, it's just kind of even uncomfortable to look at because it's so warm, but I think it will be a really nice winter shawl slash scarf. And the gray and the green are the favorite color palette of the moment for this recipient. So I'm hoping that it will be a well-received gift. Once again, that's the Hapa shawl, H-A-P-A, by Emski Knits. The Front Porch. I have two new projects in progress. The first is the three-color cashmere cowl by Hohi Locatelli. I am altering this pattern for 8 different colors of yarn because I'm using some hand spun that I spun. I believe I spun this last summer. It was a collection of hobbledehoy batlings in the wildflower colorway. I have 8 different small portions of yarn, 415 yards total. So I'm following the basics of the pattern with these colors, but I'm altering in some cases the amount of knitting I'm able to do in each section. This yarn is just beautifully soft. It's not just hand spun, it's spindle spun, and it has a gorgeous hand. I think there's a little bit of silk content in this. I don't think there's cashmere, so I hope Hohi Locatelli, you know, doesn't mind that I'm not using cashmere in the cashmere cowl. But I really, it's fast, it's easy, it's kind of addictive to see how all of these colors work out, and I'm having a lot of fun. I also think this is a great pattern for a gift. Something just luxurious and special that could be worn by almost any woman of any age. I'm taking a tip from someone else who knit this cowl and used size 5 needles for the cast on and then gradually worked to size 3 needles. so that the opening around the neck and shoulders is somewhat larger than the opening at the top of the neck. It creates kind of a funnel shape. And I think that will make a more relaxed cowl. So I'm trying that method. I am in the stripey section of the cowl and I have slowly graduated to US size 3 needles. I have also cast on Blom, which is a shawl pattern by Melody of the Bee Mandarines podcast. I received from my pen pal and now in-person friend, Fernanda, the gift of some gorgeous purple. It's just a very slightly tonal purple yarn from Yarns to Inspire in Avon, Connecticut. I believe that's local to Fernanda. It's the Serenity Base. It's 100% superwash merino, and the colorway is Bubblicious. I think this is a sport weight. There are only 325 yards per 100 grams, so it's slightly more plush and plump than a fingering weight yarn, but I have 2 skeins, and I think this would work up into a very lovely, luscious, big shawl. So far, I'm really enjoying the pattern. It's nicely charted. It's also written, I think. I'm just following the chart. And I haven't gotten to the part where there's a little bit of a special stitch pattern. So I'm looking forward to this little bloom motif stitch pattern. And I think the pattern links to a video where Melody shows you how to pick up those stitches and knit that little part. So I'm enjoying both of those knits, and I'm hoping that the combination of that yardage with the spinning that I will be completing today and tomorrow for Tour de Fleece will inch me ever closer to my 5K goal for Stash Dash. Currently, I have 1,800 yards to go, and I do have quite a bit of additional knitting planned. I'm also going to be swatching for the Miranda sweater for a Christmas gift for my sister. And I have a pair of socks that have been on the needle since Valentine's Day. So if I really turn it on, maybe I could finish those socks as well. Although I'm not a very proficient sock knitter. So that might end up being more trouble than it's worth, but that's pretty much my only work in progress that's kind of languishing that I might finish up to score additional yardage for Stash Dash. There's also spinning I can do for Tour de Fleece and my sheep to shawl class, and I guess I could also warp a loom and do a weaving project as well. I have a Cricut loom that I'm planning to use with my young students, my spinners and knitters, and I have not yet worked with a Cricut loom, so I brought it home for the summer thinking I would warp the loom and sort of figure out all of the kinks before I assist them in working with it. And here July is almost over and I haven't done that yet. So there are 15 days in August remaining in Stash Dash. Maybe I can turn it on and get a weaving project underway very soon. Off the Shelf. The summer read-along continues with Color, A Natural History of the Palette by Victoria Finlay. I think this week is dedicated to orange, but I am just finishing up the red chapter. And I also made a little excursion into dyeing with cochineal. So I'd like to read a little bit from the opening of the chapter on red, because I think The exploration of red is so interesting. It's what I've been waiting to get to since I opened this text. And then at the beginning of the chapter, I found some very surprising information that I didn't know about the paintings of William Turner. And I just have seen, I guess within the past 6 months, there was a really excellent film about the life of William Turner at our independent cinema. And so a lot of that is very fresh in my mind as I'm reading. The painting should have had a streak of color in a sunset sky, but instead it just shows a gray wash over a dull afternoon. When Joseph Mallord William Turner ran his sable brush swiftly across the canvas of Waves Breaking Against the Wind, it carried a ruby slick of oil paint where the sun's last colors were supposed to hit the clouds. But when you see it today, the carmine pigment, like the day the artist was imagining, has disappeared into memory. They didn't always listen, the great masters. Turner had been warned many times not to use paints that faded, but that day in 1835 or so, when he was gazing at his workbox thinking of the pink sunset and a violent sea, he chose his brightest red, even though he knew it would not last. Or perhaps he even liked the idea. After all, his paintings celebrate change. His skies and seas are a stormy riot of variety in nature and light, and the notion that the work would alter over time as well as canvas space may have been a delightful personal joke. According to Joyce Townsend, who is senior conservation scientist at Tate Britain in London, Mr. Windsor of Windsor & Newton remonstrated with him about some of the pigments he was buying, saying he didn't know that these aren't going to last, but Turner told him to mind his own business. He didn't care. Dr. Townsend has spent many hours in the studios and laboratories of Tate's conservation department poring over canvases and tiny fragments of paint with a microscope. You learn a surprising amount about artists when you're that close, she said. In Turner's case, she has not only learned about his sloppy work practices, but has found that his bequest to the nation is considerably less colorful now than when he left it for future generations of art experts to study. Apparently, if a customer marched in brandishing an oil painting or a watercolor that had already faded, Turner would not even deal with the issue. He once said that if he repainted a watercolor for one person, he would have to do it for everyone, and that would be to acknowledge publicly that there was a problem. No picture of Turner's is seen in perfection a month after it is painted, wrote the art critic John Ruskin, adding that one painting, The Opening of Walhalla, had cracked within just 8 days of being hung in the heated Royal Academy of Arts for the annual exhibition, because the artist had only just finished painting it. If Turner, who used to leave finished canvases in the damp corners of his studio, letting the rain drizzle on them and green mold to thrive on the egg-based primer, and who even ripped a tear into one painting to make a flap for his seven Manx cats, cared little about 8 days, it was unlikely he would have wasted energy thinking about 80 or 180 years ahead. Notoriously careless of posterity, at the moment that his art most mattered to him, which was the very moment it was being created, Turner would use the paint that served his immediate desire and damn the future. I just thought that was such great writing about, you know, something that's just so fixed and so old as, you know, the work of an artist who was painting in 1835. So I'm really enjoying Victoria Finlay's writing. I continue to check Google image searches for references to the paintings discussed in the work. I'm not familiar with all of them. Though I'm familiar with the work of Turner, I really couldn't call to mind the specific painting that she referenced, this Waves Breaking Against the Wind. And so I've included a link to Tate's image in the show notes for this episode. And based on my reading of this chapter, which has spanned across a couple of weeks, I decided to experiment a little bit in dyeing with cochineal. I made a visit recently to New York City and visited very briefly Brooklyn General, just because I wanted to see this yarn and fabric shop for myself. And I had a few hours to kill, so I took a trip over from Manhattan into Brooklyn. It is a charming, charming shop. It's not very big, but it contains a great variety of yarns, also fabrics, notions, patterns. And there was this little shelf set up, almost like an apothecary shelf, with some vials of different dyes and pigments. So I could not resist a 1/4 ounce little jar of cochineal. It's a very, very finely pulverized powder. I did a little bit of reading, and when I got home, I set aside some polypay fiber that I had cleaned and washed, and I gave that a soak in an alum mordant, and then I added the cochineal powder to a dye pot just to see what would happen. It is a brilliant, brilliant red. And I didn't put very much fiber into the dye pot, so there's still quite a bit of pigment left in the dye. I did not toss it because I thought maybe I would try to mordant some yarn or some combed top that I have and reuse the liquid from the dye pot. Or maybe even try a solar dyeing method where I just submerge the fiber that's been mordanted, but I just submerge it in the jars and leave it out in the sun for about a week rather than heating it on the stove. Right now, the fiber has been removed from the dye pot. I did heat it just to a very gentle simmer for about an hour, and then I left the fiber in the dye pot overnight until everything was cool. I removed it this morning. It's drying, and then I hope that when I rinse out the fiber, the color will have truly bit into the fleece. We'll see what happens. But it's a really nice addition to the different yarns and fibers that I've been dyeing for my sheep to shawl class. The more color variation I achieve with my dyed yarns, the more I start to panic about what I'm going to knit with all of these colors that will be an interesting piece rather than just a mismatch. So I continue to think about that. Of course, I have until December, but it doesn't stop me from having anxiety about it in July. If you have any interest in color, pigment, dyeing, painting, I highly encourage you to check out Color, A Natural History of the Palette by Victoria Finlay. Join in our summer read-along at any time. This read-along extends until the end of the summer, so there's still plenty of time to get the book and just start reading around a little bit. It's really interesting writing, lively, with a lot of informative details and references to historical events, paintings, figures from the art world. I'm really learning a lot. The last thing I wanted to mention in this episode is that the Asymmetrical will begin officially on August 1st. This is a craft along. You could knit, crochet, weave, or sew a garment or accessory that is asymmetrical in some way. It could be an asymmetrical design, asymmetrical construction, or even asymmetrical use of color. There are certainly many knitting designs and patterns out there that capitalize on asymmetrical design and construction. And then a number of crochet and sewing patterns that you might explore and do the same. You are welcome, if you've been listening along and just a little bit too impatient to wait for August 1st, you are welcome to pick up a work that's already in progress or to complete something during the craft along for a chance to enter for prizes. The knit along will continue until the end of September, so that's 2 months to work on projects. And certainly you are welcome to double dip into any other contests or, you know, prize drawings that might overlap with the time frame or the type of garment that you're making. There are some great prizes. I have a locked prize thread, but it does have photographs of the prizes as they come in. Emily of Fibertown has just sent me a photograph of some beautiful cochineal dyed yarn for one of the prizes. So that's on its way, and I'll add that to the list. There's a project bag by Joanna Spring of Knit Spin Farm. There are two books that are available for prizes, and I am still accepting other prizes, certainly, if there's something that you would like to contribute, or if you have an Etsy shop or something like that and you'd like to contribute a prize and receive some mentions on the Yarns at Yinhu podcast, send me a personal message on Ravelry and let me know.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves her down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stone to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire. Just like Linda Kurtz sings, burn out on a wire. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider liking the show's Facebook page or joining the Yarns at Yinhu group on Ravelry or leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
Nature's ever get you high till your face is mine. Jump on a river naked, hike a country mile. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.